Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Our Film Week program with our critics joining us, Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, Christy Lemire of RogerEbert.com and co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, and Charles Solomon, the critic on animation, Animation Scoop, and Animation Magazine. We begin with the conclusion of the X-Men series, Dark Phoenix, written and directed by Simon Kinberg. He's longtime X-Men producer. The film stars Sophie Turner, Jessica Chastain, Jennifer Lawrence, Michael Fassbender, and James McAvoy. Tim, Dark Phoenix.
Okay, so this extremely messy film takes place after X-Men First Class and Days of Future Past, but before the original X-Men film, which came out back in 2000, was set contemporarily to the time, right? These little excursions into the past that these X-Men films insist on making, I hate them. They're just a mess because they're always doing stupid things in the past that makes the films from the future make no sense. So none of these movies make any sense, and I like for my cinematic Marvel superhero universes to make a little bit of sense. These movies, Famke Janssen played Dark Phoenix in 5 X-Men films. Okay? Rebecca Romijn Stamos played Raven, who is also Mystique, which is another complicated thing. Raven and Mystique, same person, right? A complicated little thing. Played her in 3 films, right? Thus, Christy, how can the events of this film have ever happened since we know all of those things are going to happen and a whole bunch of films that didn't get made yet?
I think it's so sweet that you want logic. That
it's
you want
cute.
Like a time-space continuum that we can all follow. This is a mess. I mean, visually, it's noisy, not just from a narrative perspective, but just the way it looks. The effects look terrible. Mm. It's a noisy mess. There's a scene toward the beginning where one guy says, oh, so we're doing space missions now? And I'm like, really? We are?
Yeah.
That's where we're like X-Men in space. It sounds like a parody of like a has-been X-Men idea. Here's a quick anecdote. The fire alarms went off in our screenings.
Yeah.
Giant auditorium. Giant at the end of it, the big set piece at the very, very end, and you hear this boop, boop throughout the entire thing. No one knew that it wasn't part of the movie. We all thought that was like an aesthetic choice.
Wow.
During the giant fight scene at the end. Only when it was eventually silent and the alarm kept going off, do we realize, oh, that's not part of the movie.
Yeah, yes.
But that just shows you how cacophonous
what was
and
just
like
another
scattered.
Screaming noise. It made no difference whatsoever.
Anxiety inducing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's this incredible cast. And I actually like these prequel X-Men movies because I love Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy as Magneto and Professor X.
Mm.
And it's great to see real actors trying to sink their teeth into this silly material. But a lot of this movie is just, you know, people who really know how to act kind of like shoving their hands out in front of them and like flailing and grunting to force the power in the directions they want it to go.
Yeah.
And like, this is just silly. And it's so self-serious.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a great description because I so see it.
Poor yeah, Michael Fassbender.
Well, you notice Larry is keeping his microphone suspended just with his extrasensory
right.
perception
and I'm
forces.
Levitating too. Dark Phoenix, the conclusion of the X-Men series, written and directed by Simon Kinberg, rated PG-13 in wide release. The adventure comedy The Secret Life of Pets 2 is directed by Chris Renaud and Jonathan Delval. Charles?
Well, this is our second mess in a row. Remember, the original Secret Life of Pets was kind of a vehicle for Louis C.K., and once his behavior came out, he got dropped from it, and he's replaced by Patton Oswalt, who gives Max the Terrier a charm and an appeal I don't think Louis C.K. could muster. But then they don't give him very much to do. His owners have a baby, and he becomes so concerned about the baby and so anxious, he starts scratching and has to wear, you know, the cone of shame from Up. Well, then he goes to a farm where the older, wiser, grizzled mentor, who's Harrison Ford playing essentially Paul Newman's part in Cars and Sam Elliott's part in The Good Dinosaur, tells him not to be afraid. And he rescues a sheep that looks like the one in Bounden, except he hasn't been afraid. He's been nervous. That's not the same thing. There are subplots involving a cruel Russian circus master abusing a young white tiger. None of it ever comes together. And you sit and go, okay, the rabbit looks like the one in Presto. Little Old Lady is the one from the beginning of Ratatouille. It just never comes together. And the idea was to do for pets what Toy Story did for toys. Mm-hmm. And my cat is not a jerk. You know, I think he sits home and reads when I'm not there, but he doesn't do this kind of nasty stuff. And I'm really tired, again, of more poop and pee and snot and cat box jokes.
The Secret Life of Pets 2, the animated film, Christie?
The problem with this movie is that it's the individual nuggets of ideas for three short films. If this had been three individual short films, it would have been delightful, quick, in and out, a lot of fun. But they stitch all three of these subplots together really awkwardly and then stretch them out to feature length, and they barely make it. And they jump really awkwardly from one story to the next, and it feels very episodic. Like, here's a thing that happens, and then here's a thing that happens, and then here's a thing that happens, without building a whole lot of momentum, either individually or as a whole. And eventually, the three stories all collide. And
collide is the exact white.
Yeah,
exact
verb.
This is a very banal message about bravery. Someone learns to be brave in all three of them.
Oh, is that what it was?
I guess.
Oh, okay.
Right.
Okay.
One's a superhero, right?
I didn't know that either.
It's an extremely kinetic movie. Incredible. Violent to my taste. And I was with this friend with a little girl, and the little girl didn't mind the violence at all, but it bothered me that she didn't mind the violence at all, because it's insanely violent. People get hit by cars and stuff. It's moving. I grew up on Wile E. Coyote and Tom and Jerry and all that kind of stuff, but you know, I don't know. This is like,
because he just gets right up after he smashed flat.
This is
weird. Two-dimensional and drawn.
And I'll tell you another thing. For a movie set in New York City, with no actual black people in it, there are actually no black people in this movie. Now Kevin is voicing that little white bunny, which is kind of funny in and of itself. And Tiffany is voicing, I guess it's a Pekingese or something
She's
that.
She's a Shih Tzu.
A Shih Tzu, thank you. And they bring so much blackness to these two characters that the whole movie is like totally black. And by the time we get to the third act, it's all hip-hop music, and the bunny is bouncing, and got the car jumping up and down. I'm like, this is the blackest movie I've ever seen with no actual
black
people in
characters.
It. Yeah, it's very strange.
Yeah, and that Shih Tzu character is sort of the hippo from the Madagascar movies, and Ellie from the Ice Age movies, and we've all seen them before.
Yeah. As my kid pointed out, there are like 8 trailers for this film, one for each of the major characters. And so if you've seen them, as kids have seen them, because they can look at them on YouTube, you have seen everything that's funny in this movie. So my kid's like, I already saw this whole movie. He was bored.
The Secret Life of Pets 2, animated film starring the voices of Patton Oswalt, Kevin Hart, Harrison Ford, Tiffany Haddish, Chris Renaud, and Jonathan Del Valle, the directors. Brian Lynch wrote it. It's rated PG in wide release. The drama The Last Black Man in San Francisco stars Jimmy Fails, Jonathan Majors, and Danny Glover. Joe Talbot, the director and co-screenwriter with Rob Rickard. Tim?
Jimmy Fails playing a character called Jimmy Fails in this sort of a slightly fictionalized version of his own experience in San Francisco. Gentrification and all of these sorts of things come to bear. But this is an extremely gentle movie. It's constructed in this beautiful, gentle way. There's poetry in this movie. There's cinematic poetry in this movie. There's actual poetry in this movie. But what this movie is telling us is a brutal story, a story that about a community that's being hurt deeply. But it can see it. It can see the whole story. It can even see the gentrifiers being gentrified. I love that in this movie, what happens to the white lady that has the house. So it's a story about a young man and his relationship with this home that was his family home. The home was lost.
Is this in the Fillmore District?
The Fillmore District of San Francisco, which, as we all know, is becoming, relatively speaking, unlivable for most people, let alone middle class and poor black and brown folks, which is what this district is. We see this community, and we see all these young black men, and man, I got to tell you, I just love that, the way they talk, the way they do things, the pain that they live in all day, every day. And this one character can see it all, and he's writing this play, and he's putting all of this in this play. This movie just overwhelmed me completely. It's so beautiful in every possible way. But what's most beautiful about it is that it simply tells the truth. This is what's happening. There's no use in whining about it, but you're going to have to figure out a way to let go.
This is one of the best movies of the year. It is excellent. I was blown away from the first frames. It's a mixture of dreaminess and grittiness at once. It's like a fairy tale, but it doesn't shy away from the reality of what is happening in the city. It tells a story of economic disparity without being heavy-handed. Mm. It's sumptuously beautiful, and I cannot believe this is Joe Talbot's first feature. I would never know that. It's so assured. It's so ambitious. It's just gorgeous and mesmerizing, and just see it. Don't even read about it. See it.
The Last Black Man in San Francisco, starring Jimmy Fails, Joel Talbot directed and co-wrote it. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. Coming up, we'll hear about the comedic drama Late Night, starring Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. Kaling wrote the screenplay for it. First time she's had one of her screenplays produced into a feature film. We'll also hear about Ron Howard's documentary Pavarotti. That coming up.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artist's major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I'm joined by film critics Christy Lemire, Charles Solomon, and Tim Cogshell. Next up is the dramatic comedy or comedic drama, Late Night, starring Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling. Kaling also wrote the screenplay for the film, which is directed by Nisha Ganatra. Tim, why don't you start us on Late Night?
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed this film. The director happens to be a Canadian woman of Indian descent, who, along with a great many other television critics, can count the Mindy Kaling Project as one of the programs that
she
directed.
So they've worked together.
So they had worked together before. I think that has something to do with this, a sort of connectivity there. But here, the script is, in fact, the thing. Mindy has written a very pointed and very sharp, not exactly the same thing, a script that is funny. It mostly is funny. So it's about who I guess would be the first and only female late-night nightly talk show host, played by Emma Thompson. And she has this totally sort of male writing room. The suggestion at the beginning of the film is that she doesn't like female writers. And that was an odd little thing that was noted at the beginning of the movie. That sort of floats away as the film goes on. Anyway, Mindy wins a contest or something, and she ends up writing on the show, and she experiences what one might think that a extremely dark-skinned woman of Indian descent might experience, writing in an all-white male sort of preppy writing room. You know, once 1,000 years ago, when I was coming out of high school, about 1979, I thought to myself, I think I could write for one of these shows. I'm kind of funny, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And I went and looked it up, and I looked up all the writers that were writing for the David Letterman show, and they were all white men who went to Yale or Harvard.
And those great comedy factors.
It's great comedy fact. Harvard Lampoon guys, you know, and all that kind of stuff. But there weren't any women. And if, for whatever reason, I don't know whether that pushed the notion out of my mind, but the notion left my mind. Fast, you know, eventually had the Arsenio Hall show and all kinds of neat things. But to this very day, there still aren't any women hosting a nightly talk show. And there aren't that many women.
Isn't Chelsea Handler's
show?
Yeah,
she's the last one I was thinking of. Yeah.
Joan Rivers, I think, was the first, and she filled in for Carson.
She filled in for Johnny quite
and then
a lot,
got
but
her
she
own
didn't.
Show.
But she, but she didn't get that show. She didn't get the Tonight Show, which was the show that she expected to get.
Yeah, and then Arsenio took over her show.
Her show, yeah. So a weird little melange of things that have happened there. But this is a good movie, sharp and pointed, I thought.
I really liked it, and I wanted to love it. And it is very much in the vein of a working girl or The Devil Wears Prada. It's sort of a sparkling and snappy workplace comedy. Emma Thompson is divine, as always. She's so mean. She's doing like what Meryl Streep did in The Devil Wears Prada. She's just this horribly withering, cruel boss, but it's hilarious every time. And Mindy Kaling is our conduit to this world, and she just couldn't be lovelier. But yeah, there's optimism and there's a guilelessness to her, but she's sharp and she doesn't take anything from any of these guys who are happy to put her in her place in a corner, and she won't take that. So I like that about it. It's almost like it pulls its punches here and there, though. I wanted more bite from it, because you know that these are women who want to dig into this, you know, the patriarchy and tear it apart. And it's almost like it's a little too nice.
Mm. And then there's that thing that they do to Emma's character. Not going to give it away. And I thought to myself, why did we do that? Why did we do that to her character? Why did we do that? That isn't a thing that's going on in society right now. The other thing that's going on in society right now, men behaving badly, mm-hmm. is what's going on in society. So, I don't know, didn't care for that either. But is this funny? Is it sharp? Is it socially relevant? It absolutely is.
And they have lovely chemistry with each other, these two ladies. Yeah.
You also raise such an interesting issue, Tim, and that is sort of this transition from, you know, early television comedy really being sort of Jewish outsiders, the kids of immigrants to the country, you know, making mainstream comedy out of their particular immigrant experience. And somehow that transitioned into these Ivy League graduates, you know, from a very different cultural background becoming dominant as writers.
It's a very interesting thing. And suddenly jokes become about Jean-Paul Sartre. And I'm sorry, my grandmother isn't going to get that.
Yeah, I'd say even I'm more Borscht Belt than myself. But Late Night is the film written by Mindy Kaling, who stars with Emma Thompson, Nisha Ganatra, the director. It's rated R. It's at the Arclight Hollywood and the Landmark in West L.A. And in another week, it'll go into wide release. Also, The Frame's John Horn talked with Emma Thompson about the film. You can hear that conversation in the link from our Film Week page or by visiting kpcc.org/theframe. The Chilean film Too Late to Die Young stars Demian Hernandez and Antar Machado. It's written and directed by Dominga Sotomayor Castillo. Tim, what'd you think of Too Late to Die Young?
I love this perfectly lovely little movie set in Chile. You have this community of people. In the city, things are going crazy, kind of like today in Venezuela. So they decide to move out toward the Andes, to the foot of the Andes, and they start this little community with all of these families. The movie follows this one young woman coming of age between her father and her mother. Her mother didn't want to leave the city, so she went there with her father and her dog and her little sister. And it's all about her resentment of what her parents are doing to her, of what society is doing to her, about how she's in the midst of her rebellion, but it's an internal rebellion, and she just sort of turns it all in on herself. And it's just this powerful, powerful, interesting little movie. Interesting also that the young actress who played her in the movie has since transitioned and is now a young man, which is a sort of interesting thing that just sort of happened outside the scope of the film. But the film even kind of speaks to that in terms of identity and the way we identify ourselves, the way she's identifying herself. A really quiet and moving little movie. I enjoyed it quite a lot.
Too Late to Die Young is unrated. It's at Lemley's Music Hall in Beverly Hills. Pavarotti, a documentary from Ron Howard. It's rated PG-13. Charles.
Well, Christy, I think you had le mot juste earlier once again when you said this is worshipful, which it is. And it's also clearly by someone who doesn't know very much about opera, except for the very beginning where you see the famous clip of Pavarotti in Le Fils du Regiment, where he tosses off the high C's as if they're nothing. It doesn't tell you very much about what made him so significant and so stellar an operatic star. And they don't tell you, for example, you'll see a clip of him singing, they'll put the lyric, translate the lyrics underneath, but they don't necessarily tell you what opera he's singing, what the character is, what it's about, or even who he's singing with. And, for example, in one clip from La Boheme, that's Mirella Freni with him, who isn't exactly chopped liver. There are lots of things talking about, oh, yes, he was so great, so talented, rare footage of him, interviews with his family members, his two ex-wives, his daughters. He also kind of glides over the sideshow attraction Pavarotti turned himself into. I mean, I hadn't known he knew the Princess of Wales and did a lot of charity work as a result, but he also became such a caricature of himself. There's nothing from Yes, Giorgio in here, no clips. And in doing so, he overused and abused his voice so that later on in his life, when he tried to go back on the stage, that golden instrument wasn't there anymore. And Bono, who did a rock song for him, is very shirty about the whole business, saying, well, why are they critiquing him for this? He had to live those songs to sing them. No, it's not a question of his acting ability. It's that his voice was no longer what it once had been. And so it's, again, there's wonderful rare footage. He was an amazing singer, particularly in his early days, but I felt this was less than it could have been.
We're talking about the documentary Pavarotti from Ron Howard Christie.
I am not an opera expert, I will admit that. I have been to the opera, but I don't really know that much about it, as you do, Charles. But I did find it a bit superficial, even though they have this great access to a lot of archival footage. A lot of it's quite entertaining, but this is not in any way a warts and all depiction of Pavarotti. What I thought was interesting was the part about how when he does a concert, just him standing next to a piano and having to sing, not in costume, not in character, he didn't know what to do. And what was it, his manager who said, just hold on to your handkerchief?
Yeah.
And that became like a signature thing for him.
Yeah,
so that was
right.
Kind of cool. I saw this in a theater with terrific sound, a Dolby screening room. So I'd recommend, if you do love opera and if you do want to see this, go see it in a theater that has really great sound, because that is awesome.
Hear that instrument at its very best, Tim.
Yeah, it's certainly a legacy film. This is a film about his legacy. His legacy includes a great deal of wonderful things, being that magnificent tenor that he was, and a few other interesting moments in his life. Talking about interesting footage in this film of Pavarotti with Spike Lee in like 1983, because he did this whole big program in New York. I'm like, really? Pavarotti and Spike? If you bet me a nickel, I lost that bet. Warts and all. No, not warts and all. They do, of course, explore the fact that, you know, he cheated on his longtime wife, his first wife, with young singers, proteges, and then he cheated on those proteges with even younger proteges. And you know, this was a thing that he did, and that's in the movie. His regret about not being a very good father to his children, that's in the movie. And all of these people talk about him, including that very, very, very first wife. They still adore him. They still adored him, no matter what he did. And I think that that's the thing about this movie. There were warts. He made mistakes. The voice was gone long before his career was over. All true, but there he was, still being Pavarotti.
And that charisma coming through.
Yeah.
Yeah, as opposed to Placido Domingo, who's in the movie, who husbanded his resources much more intelligently and is still singing beautifully.
We're talking about the documentary Pavarotti. Ron Howard directs. It's rated PG-13, and it's showing at the Arclight Hollywood and the AMC Century City. Coming up, we'll hear about the film Papi Chulo, which is set in Los Angeles. Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation, new documentary from Barrick Goodman. And The Lavender Scare, a documentary that goes back to the treatment of gay men during the Eisenhower administration. It's Film Week on KPCC.
Support for LAist comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This fascinating exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. With over 200 prints on view, this exhibition offers insight into the artist's creative process and the full range of his expressive capacity. Now on view. More information at nortonsimon.org.
It's Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Larry Mantle with our critics Charles Solomon, Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire. Next up, the L.A. set Papi Chulo, starring Matt Bomer and Alejandro Patino. John Butler's the writer-director. Christy?
This is going to sound like pure formula, but they do find new ways into this story that we have seen before and seen very recently before, actually. So Matt Bomer is a weatherman here in L.A. They don't really get TV news right, but most films don't. Nothing about it looks right.
L.A. Story is about the only one.
The set looks wrong. Anyway, so he's a TV news weatherman, and he's having a really rough day, and he has a breakdown on air. We find out it's because of the end of a relationship. He is gay, and the end has come for him and his longtime partner. He goes home to recover, and he tries to get rid of this plant that reminds him of his ex-lover, and he goes to the hardware store to find a day laborer to help him repaint the deck. And the gentleman, Ernesto, ends up becoming his friend. And they spend afternoons together, and they hang out and do things that aren't necessarily painting the deck. They become friends. And there is, like, the danger of this becoming, like, a magical, you know, person of color.
Mm.
But then it is sweeter than that, and it takes some turns.
Absolutely.
And they
absolutely
have some nice chemistry. And I like there's a goofiness to Matt Bomer. He's so ridiculously handsome, like perfectly, impeccably handsome, but he lets himself be really goofy and just inappropriate. And I like that he's toying with his own image here.
Yeah, Matt is one of the dancers in those stripper movies with
Magic Mike.
Matt's from St. Louis, too. We're all handsome, you know.
All of you.
And magical, right? Yes.
I love this movie so much. This is a bromance where only one of the characters knows that they're in a bromance. Ernesto has no idea he's in a bromance. He speaks Spanish, and Matt's character speaks just enough Spanish to sort of, you know, get him going with stuff. And slowly but surely, Ernesto starts to figure out, oh, wait a minute, I think this guy wants to be a friend of mine, and he goes to his house. A lot of people are complaining that this movie treads and stereotypes about both gay men and Latino immigrants, particularly blue collar immigrants, and you know it does. But I say so what? For one thing, some of these stereotypes are true, and when they're not used viciously or to hurt, but to simply frame things, contextualize things, what's wrong with that? So he's a gay man, and he has these sort of tropes of being a gay man, a certain kind of gay man, are in the movie. And Ernesto is an immigrant man who's working an immigrant with his family, and that's in the movie. I don't see anything wrong with that. I like that. I like that the relationship that they have is an earnest relationship, and they come by it fairly because they have things in common. And when you come to understand why Matt picked him in the first place, and you will before the movie is over, there's a reason why he picked him. It really brings it home.
And it also subverts those stereotypes at the same time, I would say. And it humanizes both of these characters and allows for shading and surprises. And the Ernesto character is hilarious because he's like, what am I doing here? And we're thinking that too. But then there's unexpected emotional heft as the film goes on. And it's very sweet. There is somebody who actually makes a Driving Miss Daisy reference to them, seeing them together out in the world, saying out loud what we're thinking.
Yeah.
And this movie, you know, Green Book, I don't think had existed yet when this film was made, but it's got all that going on too, but it's better.
Yeah.
Papi Chulo is the film starring Matt Bomer and Alejandro Patino, John Butler, the writer-director, rated R. It's at the AMC Sunset. Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation, documentary from Eric Goodman. The film's unrated. Christy?
So in case you weren't aware, the 50th anniversary of Woodstock is coming up in a couple of months here. And so we're seeing lots of stuff to commemorate that. And this film is one of them. It features a bunch of behind-the-scenes footage stitched together with voiceover from people who were involved in Woodstock from various perspectives, whether it's the original planners or the person who was in charge of the stage and the sound design, to just random folks who attended Woodstock. And it has sort of the same sort of structure as the documentary Room 237 about The Shining, in that you don't see the people, you hear them layered over images. And so
sometimes images of themselves from 1969.
And so it does bring a freshness to a story that we've heard a million times and which has been mythologized incessantly, especially now as we get close to that anniversary. There have been so many documentaries celebrating 60s music and this concert in particular. But it makes you realize, like, this was almost the fire festival. Oh. Like, so much went wrong. Leading up to it, they barely had a stage. Like, they could either have a fence,
mm-hmm,
or they could have a stage where the bands could actually play. And they picked the stage because they only had, like, X amount of time to get it all done. It's amazing to think that so much of it was slapped together and so much of it was just done with love. Like, people looking out for each other, feeding each other, them having to helicopter in food, like, random neighbors putting canned goods into boxes. So it finds little intimate ways and anecdotes into a story that we have heard a million times.
Yeah, this film actually begins 3 years before Woodstock. And a good three quarters of the film is about everything that it took to sort of get us there. And it's lovely in that way and kind of moving. I think the only real complete performance we see is Richie Havens, which of course was the first performance at Woodstock.
And how that happened is an interesting story as well. Yeah, there's not a whole lot of music. Even like the Jimi Hendrix, you know, Star Spangled Banner, we hear pieces of of it, but you want Woodstock music, there are other documentaries that will give you the Woodstock music.
Woodstock, 3 days that defined a generation, from filmmaker Barrett Goodman. It's unrated at the New Art Theater in West Los Angeles. John Horn talked with Barrett Goodman about the movie earlier this week. That interview has a link on our Film Week page. The documentary The Lavender Scare looks at the Eisenhower administration and its attitudes and approach to gay men who were government workers at the time. Glenn Close narrates the film. Charles.
Well, this is well-intended, but I think repetitive and kind of fragmented. And it wasn't just the Eisenhower era. These bars to gay men and women working in the government went on until President Clinton. There are sort of three films in this, that any one of which might have been more interesting. They had actually talked to some of the inquisitors who ruined people's lives and apparently feel no regret for having done so. There's a woman who had a good chance to become the first female admiral in naval history, who didn't try for it because she was aware that she could be ruined. And there is an astronomer who refused to listen to the government and continued to harass and sue and provide legal counsel for people until finally the barriers fell, and who was honored by Barack Obama. But it's a kind of a tangled film that seems to be saying the same things over and over without really adding much to its previous statements.
It's based on the book The Lavender Scare, the Cold War persecution of gays and lesbians in the federal government. David K. Johnson wrote that. Josh Howard directed the documentary. Tim, quick comment on it?
And of course, the Red Scare morphed into the Lavender Scare because they were running out of communists. So they decided to start hunting gay people, gay men and women. And these rules were still in force until the mid-1980s.
Well, also the Red Scare became the Lavender Scare because they figured, oh, if someone's gay and closeted, they are going to be prime for blackmail, so they can't have access to, you know, security secrets here. I learned a lot and did not know a lot about this. I knew pieces of this, but it does kind of tell the same type of story over and over again, just from various perspectives.
The Lavender Scare, about government discrimination against lesbians and gay men. Glenn Close narrates. The film, from Josh Howard, is unrated. It's screening at Lemley's Music Hall Theater in Beverly Hills. So good to have you with us on Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Our critics this week, Tim Cogshell, Christy Lemire, and Charles Solomon. And I sure hope that you'll join us at the Theater at the Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Saturday, July 27th. Our next Film Week screening, Boogie Nights, for adult audiences. Your tickets are available from us right here at KPCC.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.